Welcome to Inspired to Heal, where I interview innovators, educators, clinicians, and leaders in government-run health institutions. Season 1 focuses on former staff at Cook County Hospital, Chicago's safety net health system. I'm Bill Trick, your host for Inspired to Heal. Today we welcome Dr. Ben Emba, former firm chief at Cook County Hospital, esteemed educator and master clinician who Dr. Sanjay Saint shadowed for his book, Teaching Inpatient Medicine. He's currently a professor of medicine and vice chair for diversity, equity, and inclusion for the Department of Internal Medicine at Yale School of Medicine. Despite his many accolades, he does have a flaw. He never learned to appreciate attending a baseball game. Ben, welcome to Inspired to Heal, and great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Bill. It's an honor to be here, and I really must thank you for putting in the effort and the time to capture these stories for Cook County. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, and I hope that reaches people and inspires them. Let's start with the most important question. Do you spell whiskey with an E or without the E?
Oh, with an E.
You've been Americanized, Ben.
Oh, yeah. So then I have been Americanized, yeah.
What's your favorite? If you had your last wish, or your last drink, what would it be?
I think it would be something from the Macallan line, hopefully a Macallan 21, if I had the privilege. Yeah.
Ben, you are a lover of quotes. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, that is true. I am a lover of quotes. And I do try to come up with my own quotes. But I think one of my favorites is by Alexander Pope. And I use it a lot in terms of teaching clinical reasoning or just teaching. It's from A Little Learning is a Dangerous Thing. And it states that drink deep or taste not from the Pyrian spring, which is a mythical spring of wisdom. Because for shallow draughts intoxicate the brain, but then deeper draughts bring clarity as well. So I always say that to my trainees, drink deep or taste not. So basically, look, deliberate and contemplate and reflect on what's in front of you beyond the superficial.
Which has great application to clinical medicine.
Correct, yes. And in life, you know, as we all get older, like in our 50s, we don't see things the way we did in our 20s, then we were taking shallow drafts and we were very intoxicated with things. And then as you get older, life experience, you see things anew. T.S. Eliot said, we never cease from exploring. And in the end, we end up where we started and we know that place anew for the first time.
I got a bonus quote there.
Yeah. Drink deep or taste not, Dale.
Ben, you certainly were and probably still are a master of clinical medicine and a master of teaching, particularly inpatient medicine. In the words of Chris Acob, it's hard to describe a phenomenon like Ben Emba.
Oh, wow. That's very kind of her.
And I think a lot of people felt that way. Can you share with us some of the wisdom that you learned when you were teaching inpatient medicine?
Sure. I'll be honored to. I'm really honored to be considered a great clinician and a great teacher. I'm not sure one ever is. However, I think, Bill, that when we perceive people, individuals, to be good at something that they do, invariably the individuals end up inadvertently generating an illusion. And that illusion is that it's all effortless. So it comes so natural, it's so easy, it's so spontaneous. I don't dispute that there is talent in individuals, but I think you would agree that between talent and success at anything, there is, in the words of Malcolm Gladwell, there's 10,000 hours of intentionality. Mm-hmm. I think it is with teaching, like doing morning reports. I've had people say, oh, wow, you're so good at it, it comes so easy to you. But there's a lot that's not seen behind the scenes. I think when people are perceived to be good at anything, it's like a duck on a lake or a swan. On the top, it looks so graceful, but you don't see the threading underneath, which could be cognitive or physical. To bring it down to actual teaching, I think any success I've had in teaching has been a result of intentionality, in the sense that if I'm going to be in a teaching scenario, one of the first things I do is that I try to project myself into the place of the learner. And then from that perspective, I try to predict what a learner at that stage would likely be struggling with or would likely be challenged with. Mm-hmm. And then I have to prepare to be able to plant learning seeds in the learner. And I'll explain, in the sense that anyone that from high school or any of your great teachers that you remember, Bill, I bet you don't remember what they taught you at all. It's really the how. They teach you how to understand and reason and see things for yourself. So I think that in teaching, sometimes there's this rush to just transfer knowledge, a whole ton of knowledge. But I think it's more beneficial to learners to actually plant seeds that lead to self-realization, or they come to it themselves. All of that takes a lot of intentionality and preparation. This may sound like an oxymoron, but things that look spontaneous sometimes are actually a result of prepared spontaneity. So any advice I would give for teaching would be that you don't just teach on the fly. There's a lot of intentionality and preparation that goes into your mental preparation and visualization of what that learning climate would be and what you want it to be for the learners. I do incorporate a lot of humor, sometimes self-deprecating and sometimes not. But yeah, I think humor always helps to create a comfortable learning environment.
Having been the beneficiary of watching you do your morning reports, it was tremendously engaging, entertaining, challenging. It was really a fun and dynamic learning environment. And it was always a standing room only crowd that was on hand, and tremendous engagement.
Those were the fun days.
It seemed like they were all fun days. Who mentored you? Was there anyone that you observed that you said, I need a little bit of this, I need a little bit of that? You know, I imagine there are several ingredients that going into being an effective teacher. What did you learn from people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Several people. I learned a few things, but I think it's the inspiration. I think just to sum it up, I would just say teachers before me that inspired me. I would name Brendan Riley was a great inspiration. I think Christopher Smith, Brian Lucas, Arthur Evans, and your humble self, Bill.
Other than the names, and I'm not fishing for my for what you thought about me, but what were the components
of the attributes and the qualities? Yeah,
that's right.
I think the attributes would be watching people think critically was an inspiration to me. I think humor has always come natural to me, but I think critical thinking and an application of a Socratic method of teaching was something that I did not grow up with. And I think it's something that I was very inspiring watching some of the teachers that I've learned.
What I really liked that it was your style was that people would come up with an answer that you thought clearly wasn't correct or could be better, but that was never really displayed to them. It was, that's an interesting thought. What do others think?
Because I think the whole purpose of the teacher or the moderator is to encourage lifelong learning and create that safe space. The same person that may say something that was probably not the best answer on Monday may give a brilliant answer on Friday. I think you see the room as having to navigate this spectra of flashes of ideas and perspectives just coming at you at the board as the moderator, mm-hmm. right? I almost see myself as kind of like it's like an orchestra. It's a little bit like a show. And then sometimes some sounds have to be modified, some amplified, some minimized, some ideas separated from each other so that they don't propagate. So there's so much going on in that hour while you're there. I'm a very big believer in metacognition. And I tried to apply metacognition in real time when I was doing morning reports, which is thinking about how I am thinking and trying to, again, project myself into the minds of the person raising the comment and trying to see at least two steps from where they're coming from and two steps in any direction that they might be going to towards. Yeah. So there's a lot of projection and trying to read the thought patterns of others, because if you can modify and meet people in their thought stream, you can actually plant seeds of learning and actually change the direction of thought. And that would actually be a lifelong experience for that person in terms of a learning experience.
You had to have the confidence clinically to be able to be that maestro and conduct that orchestra, because you're having to think about a complicated case and think about your own clinical reasoning, but also read the room.
Correct, yes. Yeah. It's a lot going on at the same time in the cognitive space, but it's terribly rewarding, Bill. It was a very rewarding experience every time to be in that room and to leave that room.
One other feature that I wanted to congratulate you on that I noticed, and you brought this up before, is you want to tone down some of the instruments or the voices and,
yes,
and lift some of the others. And I really appreciated how there were some people more eager to contribute and others more reticent to have their thoughts publicly spoken for their peers to evaluate their clinical reasoning. You brought the quieter voices to the forefront.
Yes, correct. I think it's also important because as a teacher, you're not just there for the session, especially if you have a longitudinal relationship with the learners. Some of the interactions during that teaching session may have less to do with actual transfer of knowledge than to do with actually empowering a particular individual that is known to me in that room. Mm-hmm. I try to foster an environment where people would come in and we would accept them wherever they are, but try to create a channel that they can communicate and share their ideas with others. I think it's all about acceptance and making people feel safe. And many times I make fun of myself as well. Sometimes I will get things wrong and they would have the ability to laugh at me or say, oh, you know, you're going in the wrong direction. And so that way we can all learn safely.
Yeah, there's a particular case I remember that was your case, and you brought it to the group. And at the end, you said there was uncertainty. You still didn't know the answer.
Yeah.
But it was teaching, like you mentioned, metacognition, how you think about the clinical case, how you think about what you're thinking.
Sometimes it's more about the journey in clinical teaching than the destination, because often we don't know what's going on, to be honest, with patients.
And many times there wasn't an answer at the end of morning report, but the journey was valued and valuable. There is a prediction by Bill Gates that in 10 years, artificial intelligence will make doctors obsolete. I think about all the skills that I witnessed, the bedside clinical skills, and it seems like that's an overly either optimistic or pessimistic prediction. Any thoughts on that prediction?
Yeah, I don't think it would manifest in its entirety, but I do think that AI is definitely something that we need to reckon with. I'm optimistic that AI can actually help and improve healthcare in several ways, help diagnostically, help improve screening, especially in the radiological screening, you know, mammograms, lung cancer screening. But I always see AI as being an assist rather than an independent operator that would take over.
Yeah.
I think AI would be more of an assist. Mm-hmm. I welcome it because the cognitive horsepower equivalent of AI is phenomenal. And so why not try to harness its abilities for positive change?
Yeah. Following up on that, what are the skills and the attributes that you see of expert clinicians, some of which would be hard for AI to replicate, I think?
That's actually interesting. I think one of the key ingredients is actually, it starts with directed curiosity. I don't know if AI can inherently generate an authentic curiosity in of itself, but presumably it can, and eventually will. We all start out empathic and wanting to help patients, right? And you have to be very curious in the sense in which you can raise the right clinical question on behalf of the patient and then set about seeking the answer. Because it always starts from, are you generating the right clinical question that the clinical scenario or syndrome demands? I think interpersonal communication is absolutely essential. Being able to communicate with families, patients, and your learners, and some degree of, and a large degree of humility, actually, is necessary as well in looking after patients. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So teaching a machine humility, and we know who's programming those machines. Good luck.
But then the machines would have the advantage of not falling into all the heuristic reasoning pitfalls that we constantly encounter and cannot overcome.
There's something about being able to filter out the noise of a history as well. There's some nuance to interpreting those inputs that I think, at least initially, a machine would have trouble with.
Yeah, I agree with you, because it has to be, at best, an assist. To be able to assist physicians in separate ways, or to be able to, for instance, before you go into your clinic, could AI kind of scan all the lab results, flag things that are important, try to create a pattern for you, and then you make the ultimate decision. An example, airlines have had automated flying and computers for decades. Would anyone go into a plane without a human pilot? I doubt it. Would you travel to Europe on an Airbus without a pilot?
So that's, yeah, it would make me pause. Yeah,
I think it would be somewhat the same in medicine.
Yeah. You trained in the United Kingdom, trained a second time at Cook County. Now you work at Yale. So you've seen a nationalized health system, you've seen a local government system, and you've seen an academic center. Could you compare and contrast those three different settings?
Oh, absolutely. But before the UK, I'll start out with Nigeria.
Okay.
So in Nigeria, I did an internship, which is a resource-limited practice environment. Going to the UK was like an expansion of resources, right? Whoa. What impressed me the most, or imprinted on me the most in the UK, was the universality of healthcare. The access that, you know, of course, there were more resources, more tests, more imaging, more scans, etc., which was a steep learning curve, obviously, and then eventually I did learn all that stuff. But the fact that everyone could just walk into an emergency room, or everyone had a GP, and there was a lot of communication between the GP and the hospital consultants and discharge summaries, that really impressed me that it is possible to some degree to look after the whole population. And that actually influenced my decision when I was interviewing to come to Cook County, because as you know, Cook County is a microcosm of almost this little island of universal health, in the sense that without ability to pay and without regard to your insurance status, you get everything that's available to Cook County as regards to your healthcare. I really enjoyed practicing at Cook County because you could advocate for every patient. You were not really influenced by payer sources and so on and so forth, at least when I was there. So resource limited in Nigeria, UK resource expansion, Cook County, again, expansion, resource limited within the larger picture of healthcare in the United States. And then coming to Yale was, again, an expansion in resources and the level of care and complexity, from transplants to cutting edge cardiovascular procedures, radiological stuff. I can compare and appreciate Cook County as a safety net health system versus the Yale health system, which is actually a combination of a safety net and a tertiary health system, in the sense that, for example, in New Haven and around New Haven, Yale Hospital is the only thing in town in terms of healthcare. So we see safety net patients, Medicaid patients, underinsured patients, and then we also see CEOs and executives. So one of the striking things that occurred to me when I was earlier on in my wards, during the ward rounds in a semi-private room, so two men were sharing a room, and one person was actually homeless and had some substance use disorder, health challenges. And the other person was clearly at the upper echelon of society, at least in terms of income. I don't think I ever saw that county, that contrast within the same room, in the same day with both patients. There's also a big research element to Yale, which you don't have at county. But I think each institution and health system plays a very crucial role in healthcare in the United States. And taking those two as prototypical types of a tertiary academic institution and Cook County as a safety net teaching hospital within the community, both have a role to play. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have experienced all of the spectrums of healthcare. I think next is Australia and Canada.
Yeah. You have a few years left.
I don't know about that. I don't know about how many years, Bill. I would definitely love to be where you are now. Retired and doing something meaningful and great like you're doing.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Earlier, you mentioned upper echelon and you qualified it and said in terms of income. What other than income makes you upper echelon?
It depends. You could have upper echelon in terms of academia that is independent of income.
I'm
right.
Tapping into the African philosopher in you. Yeah. I'm trying to.
Yeah. You could have the upper echelon in the realm of academia, upper echelon in the realm of science and creativity, right? Mm-hmm. But I use the upper echelon in its socioeconomic sense because I think that's a metric that people can identify with immediately. Everybody needs money, and in many ways, money and wealth is a significant differentiating factor. Yeah.
I was probing for happiness, life satisfaction.
Oh. Yes, and you're right. Again, I think it just came out this year that the happiest countries, and I think United States dropped to number 24, happiest places to be. And I think Finland was number one. Of course, Finland, Denmark, Norway, and so on and so forth. Yeah. I think it's long been established that at a certain threshold, happiness is independent of wealth.
Agreed. Do you have a quote from the African philosopher?
Yes. There's this great contemporary African philosopher. You may have heard of him. His name is Benjamin Mba.
My favorite.
Yes. And so a lot of my quotes evolve from experience at work, teaching and looking after patients. One, I think, with patient care is always look back. You'll see the way forward. And that's to do with complicated cases that have spanned months or years. And without looking back, you know, sometimes just looking back is what you need to actually see the way forward in dealing with the case or dilemma.
Before we go on, Ben, is there a particular case that you could provide that would be a concrete example of how looking back helped you see the way forward?
Yes. So this quote came out of a case that I did for an M&M.
Morbidity and Mortality.
Yes, Morbidity and Mortality Conference. One of the first ones I did as a chief resident. This was a case of a gentleman who had come in 3 months earlier. He had a chronic hematological condition.
Blood disorder.
Yes, he had a blood disorder. Then he now came in again with atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular beating of the heart that can... irregular heart rhythm that can predispose people to a stroke. And it's not uncommon for doctors to prescribe blood thinners to prevent the stroke from atrial fibrillation. And in this case, he was started on blood thinners of his last admission or his care in the clinic. And what happened was that he came back shortly afterwards with he had bled into the lining and the cavity around his heart, his pericardium. If one had only looked back in his care to see that he actually had an existing large pericardial effusion that was there, in that case, it struck me that a simple glance backwards would have shown the way forward. And so it imprinted in me to always look back because you see the way forward.
And a machine, as we talked about
exactly,
earlier.
Exactly. can look back and forward at the same time.
In a nanosecond.
Exactly. So this is where I think that AI would be a good assist. Mm-hmm. But I want to share some, going back to teaching, Bill, and clinical reasoning and so on and so forth, or everything, not just teaching. I think that society tends to overestimate talent. As clinician educators, I think the intentionality around preparing to be effective teachers and clinicians is crucial.
Yeah, if you had to construct your perfect teacher and you put all these components together, maybe what's the top one, two qualities that really make a good teacher? I think you've mentioned projecting yourself into the learner's position.
It's very important that as the teacher, that you enjoy the process of teaching. You enjoy it, but yet you take it seriously because it's an extreme responsibility and privilege, actually, to be in that role, to be able to impact reasoning, another person's reasoning, I think is what one should aim for, not just a transfer of raw knowledge.
And that requires engagement.
That requires engagement. And that requires vulnerability on the part of the teacher, being able to be vulnerable in front of the learner, because you have to make your own reasoning transparent. It's very important that you be kind. You were in that seat at some point, right? And that's why it's important to project into the learner's space or lens.
After my interview with Ben, I spoke with Dr. Sanjay Sain, professor of medicine at the University of Michigan, chief of medicine at the Ann Arbor VA Medical Center, and author of several books, including Teaching Inpatient Medicine, What Every Physician Needs to Know. In preparation for the book, he observed Dr. Emba on rounds and during morning reports. And Sanjay had this to say.
What inspired us to do this study is that we read What the Best College Professors Do by Ken Bain. We tried to take the lessons and applied it to the attendings that we all had during our training. And we said, has this been done within internal medicine? We found that it had not been done. We decided, let's actually study this. We found 18 superb attendings around the country. We went on rounds. We went to morning report and their teaching sessions. We interviewed their current learners and their former learners. And we came up with characteristics, attributes, behaviors of superb inpatient attendings. Some of those characteristics were things that make sense. People who were enthusiastic about teaching medicine to learners, who created psychologically safe places for learners to be wrong. But then other things I would say I was a bit surprised about, and that was the role of questioning. It was a different feel than the type of questioning that you would get if you were being interrogated. There's a great line by a philosopher, Chris Jammie, who said, friends ask you questions, enemies question you. Our attendings would ask questions. They came from a place of curiosity, trying to understand the thought processes of why a learner thought it was one diagnosis rather than another, as opposed to already knowing what the answer is and then seeing where the trainee went astray in order to not humiliate or belittle, but maybe even to embarrass. The other piece that struck us was that so much of being a great attending was really just relational. It wasn't necessarily knowing the 9 causes of macrocytic anemia. It was knowing when to give the fist bump to the trainee who had been struggling with their presentation and then just did a really nice job. Asking questions in a way that invited conversation and by showing vulnerability. In some cases, we saw attendings on their first day and they set expectations, but they also would say, I'm not going to get everything right. And when I'm wrong, I'll be honest about it. And I'd want you also to be honest about it. So it was humanizing the attending in front of the team. One of the people we saw was Dr. Emba. He exemplified so many of the characteristics I just described. His enthusiasm for medicine is infectious. He used humor in a very effective way, especially self-deprecating humor. He engaged all team members by asking questions, but from a place of curiosity. And he taught a concept that I had not heard before, but I now incorporated in my own teaching. That is the concept of anticipatory medicine. We're thinking it's X, but then what if it isn't? What happens then? Or what if we get it right? What can we anticipate as the next steps and contingency plan for those next steps? Despite the recognition he had locally, regionally, nationally, there was a humility about him and what he did. There was a kindness that extended to ward clerks and clinical pharmacists and others who he interacted with. There was this real sense of mission. And I get the mission at County, because when I trained in San Francisco, that was also the mission at San Francisco General. And it's frankly the mission where I currently am. Seeing all of those different aspects embodied in one person while you're healing and educating, it just made me feel proud of being part of this profession where this person is one of our leaders.
You have just heard part one of the Ben Empa interview. Join us for part two. Ben talks about his work in diversity, equity, and inclusion, demystifies it, and allays some of the fears. You will also hear about the challenges Ben faced when taking care of relatives during a prolonged illness.
Inspired to Heal podcasts are for informational purposes only and should not be considered as health or professional advice. We are not responsible for any losses, damages, or liabilities that may arise from the use of this podcast. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the host or the guest's current or past employers.